I'll introduce Barry Blesser just to start. Dr. Barry Blesser is actually considered one of the grandfathers of the digital audio revolution. He invented and developed the first commercial digital reverberation system in the 70s, and he was also an advisor to the U.S. Justice Department on the Watergate tapes. I find that very fascinating. To put something like that on your CV, that's quite something, I think. Of course, he's mostly famous because of his publication, Spaces Speak, Are You Listening?, basically a crucial reference in the field of sound art. Dr. Blesser has published numerous papers in professional journals, has been awarded many patents on audio and signal processing. He's also a passionate advocate on the social consequences of corrosive acoustics and offers lectures and assistance to those who want to be proactive in improving the oral quality of life. And he's also an acclaimed public speaker. So we're all very curious for your presentation.
Well, thank you very much. This is actually the first time I've attended a conference electronically, so this is an experiment. I hope you can hear me in the room. Okay. As the introduction stated, I've been in the acoustics and audio business for some 40 years. When I started to write the book, I thought I understood what sound and audio and acoustics were about. But because of my situation, I said, let's take another look at the questions that are obvious. And what I discovered is that there are many, many questions which I had never thought to ask myself. And it really reduced to the fact that I didn't understand sound and hearing, even though I'd been in it. So having spent a couple of years trying to figure out what questions are worth asking, I've spent the last 10 years trying to figure out what the answers are. And this talk is to share with you what I've learned in the last 10 years about sound and hearing. And I should add that I'm going to take a different view of sound and hearing, adding to what we already know, but from a different perspective. Slide 2, please. If we want to look at sound and hearing from a larger perspective, which is what I call the evolutionary perspective, we have to ask ourselves, what's the purpose of an auditory cortex? And in looking at that, we have to realize that human beings are an extension of mammals, a large number of mammals that have been evolving for millions of years. And those mammals did not develop an auditory system for speech and music. So if we want to get to the foundation of human hearing and sound, we have to back off and what's the base? And I'm going to propose that the mammalian auditory cortex really came about to answer the following four questions. What is happening? Where are events located? Where should we look? And where are you? And I might add that the question of space and sound is actually much broader. In the 1950s, there were politically incorrect experiments in Canada on sensory deprivation, where volunteer subjects were placed into a tank where they couldn't see, hear, feel. They had no connection, no sensory connection to the outside world. And what was interesting to everyone's surprise is within half an hour, most people started having hallucinations. A few subjects had psychotic episodes, and a few of them never recovered. And the point of this experiment is to say that the human connection to the outside world is central for our mental health. And of course, sound and hearing is only one means by which we connect to the outside world. So from this perspective, let's take another look at sound and hearing. Slide 3, please. To put this in the context of the interest that many of you have, which is music and sound art, clearly the auditory cortex in humans did not evolve in order to have survival enhanced by sound and music and speech. So what then do the oral arts do? Well, I maintain that it's a trial and error experiments of over the centuries, trying one form of sound after another, and that what we have discovered about the musical arts is all a neurological artifact. They're accidents of nature that we as modern humans are taking advantage of. Therefore, it's useful to go back and say, what are the neurologic properties upon which the sound arts are based? Slide 4, please. In order to start this exercise, let's look at some of the properties of sound. And the reason we're looking at this is because the ability to hear in all mammals came about to take advantage of some of the unique properties of sound. Sound came before hearing. So what happens when we look at sound? Well, it has the property that it flows around obstacles, it goes into openings, it goes where it wants. You can hear and sense the interior state of objects. If you tap an empty box, you can hear the hollowness. Number three is really very critical. You can't have sound without energy. Energy, mechanical energy, chemical energy, gets converted into vibrations in the air. It's an energy-to-energy transfer. And if you think about vision, vision basically has energy provided by the sun, and everything else is simply reflecting of it. You can have light without any activity, anything going on. Another property of sound is it spreads over large distances as a kind of broadcasting. Sound contains time. It's a sequence of events. There's no such thing as static time in nature, static sound in nature. Everything is flowing and changing. Sound can be shared in time. You can have events coming in sequence. They can be shared in frequency, some using high and low frequencies. They can come from different directions. All these are properties of sound, and from a social perspective, number seven is critical. Sound does not respect private property. It just goes where it wants. This is a sort of a basic review of the functional behavior of sound, not the physical properties. Slide five, please. Now, my analysis is starting from this basic and saying, okay, mechanical energy creates sound, and I'm calling this conversion an event. So sonic events are the process by which the sound is created. I'm not looking at sound sources in the conventional sense. I'm looking at the physics of creation. Such events can be natural. A thunderstorm is such an event. They can be human events, as in dropping a glass on the floor. Even talking is a conversion of biologic energy into sound energy. It's a sequence. Number four is quite interesting. For all of us who've been in the oral arts, acoustics, audio, and talk about sound, if you think about it, you really don't talk about sound. You can't talk about it. There is no way of describing it. If I drop a fork on the floor and say, "What did you hear?" you will say, "You heard the fork drop on the floor." And if I say, "No, tell me about the sound," the best you can do is use a metaphor. You can't actually describe sound. And the reason for that is actually quite simple. There's no connection in your head between the auditory cortex and the linguistic cortex, and almost everything we use in language is a metaphor. You only talk about sound in terms of the event or a metaphor or by analogy, but not the sound itself. Sound broadcasts events over large areas. What's happening one place can be detected in another, and in some sense the Skype connection is a form of broadcasting over 3,000 miles. Events compete for our attention. You may have an event, me, talking to you. You may have somebody behind you writing. You have two events going on, and you can decide which one to attend to. And finally, we get to the purpose of this talk. Events create a sense of where you are. And I'm going to be looking at that aspect of sound and space through the rest of this talk. Slide six. A little bit more about hearing. Hearing evolved because somewhere in our ancient past, mammals discovered that if they had a sensory system for picking up vibrations in the air, that would enhance survival. Just as some animals can detect ultra-low frequencies or magnetic waves, every species develops sensory means to survive based on its ability to sense some aspect of the environment. Because we can hear, we then have the ability to use that information to influence actions and reactions. And in general, the auditory system evolved in some sense as another historic accident. It simply worked for our ancient ancestors. Number three, and for those of you who have not heard the word echolocation before, it's the wrong word, even though that's the word that's been used. Echolocation really means our ability to visualize a space based on hearing. And of course, dolphins and bats are well known for their ability to navigate and orient based on hearing. What you probably don't realize is human beings also have the ability to visualize a space. Most of us do not use that ability, but you can actually do so if you want to. I used to do this experiment in teaching. I would have my students volunteer to close their eyes and walk towards a wall and stop when their nose was 4 centimeters from the wall. And a large percentage of students could do it the first time. Almost everyone can learn to do it. You can hear a wall. And the idea that you can hear something that doesn't produce sounds is not fully appreciated. You can ignore it. You can pay attention to it. Number 5 is another sort of evolutionary neurology. We don't have ear lids. You have eyelids. Your auditory system is wired deep into your cortex, and you don't get control of it. This is a system that's 24/7 or always on, and it's wired in at this level for a good reason. It has survival value of warning you about events that are taking place that you should pay attention to. And just like a sleeping mother will wake up when they hear their baby cry, you don't even have to be conscious to hear. And the idea that hearing is so profound is often not appreciated in our visual culture. Slide 7. Now, with this background, we can now begin to see that Schaefer's view of the soundscape is sort of mislabeled, because it's not the sound that's interesting, it's really an eventscape. And I'm going to, from this point on in the discussion, really refer to these events and the collection of them in the environment as an eventscape. Let me define it here. An aural event is some natural, intentional, or accidental conversion of mechanical energy into sound, which is then distributed to the inhabitants of the space. And this is my definition. It's a very useful definition in the aural arts, because we are designed to be in an eventscape. We can think of sound as sound, but the human detection system really is experiencing as an event. And so the idea of describing an experience as an experiential phenomenology rather than in physics is what I'm advocating in this presentation. Slide 8. In order to talk about events, you realize that we label how they came about. So you're actually not perceiving my language and speech. You're perceiving my meaning, my intention. What's going on in your head as I talk to you is you're getting a sense of what's in my head being transferred to yours. You're extracting meaning. And most of you probably cannot hear what I'm saying as sound, but you can hear it as meaningfulness. As I said earlier, there's no language for sound itself. And the musical arts, the auditory arts, the acoustics people suffer from this. And when you listen to professionals, say in acoustics, talk about a concert hall, they'll talk about it in physics terms, but they're really not communicating anything other than a shared experience. So I might say, do you hear this, the low frequencies being absorbed? If you've never had that experience and haven't used that label, you don't know what I'm talking about. Events are always tagged in your head, given a meaning, good, bad, or neutral. And this is part of the evolution of the human sensory system. Everything in your head is given a meaning. Is it good for you? Is it bad for you? Is it irrelevant? And this process takes place beneath consciousness. You can't choose to access this. You can experience the result of it, but you can't actually watch the process. And the idea that 90% of your mental activities are beneath your consciousness, for some people, is upsetting. They like to think of themselves as having free will and being in charge of their own existence. What you see from the modern research on neuropsychology, brain scans, is a very large percentage takes place without your awareness. And of course, the sound artists take advantage of this process. But in order to take advantage of it, you have to understand it. Let's continue. But let's stay with the last two as we go forward. events are always dynamic energy. And here you have an odd paradox, because the modern technology allows you to create sounds that have no underlying event associated with them. I can sit with my computer and make up something that's totally unreal, but the brain is trying to give it a reality, even though obviously it can't. And that's probably the magic of sound arts. Taking advantage of the disconcerting quality of a brain that wants to make sense out of something that it can't make sense out of. Again, sound is only a transport mechanism. It's connection of one thing to another. And as we get involved in this process, we should really think of what's being transported. Again, the transport mechanism is only the mechanism of getting from one place to another. It's not it doesn't matter if I have my milk delivered by a truck or a train. It's the delivery that's interesting. Slide 9. This gets us to the thesis of my talk. Where are you now? And oddly enough, in this presentation right now, you're in two places, or rather, I'm in two places. I'm sitting here in my office, and I'm also up on the wall in your conference room. So to answer the question, where am I, becomes an interesting philosophical question. It's not the physicality of my body that's interesting. It's where is my presence being felt? And in fact, in this sense, I exist in two spaces. Since all of us need to figure out where we are, and we need to use our senses, I've taken a simple view of the two senses, vision and hearing. And I'm going to say we exist in a landscape of static objects and geometries. So I can physically see myself sitting here. You can physically see yourself sitting where you are. But we also exist in an eventscape of dynamic activities. And we have the contrast between the staticness of the visual world and the dynamicness of the aural world. And while it's a simplified assumption, I'm going to argue, basically, we hear events and see objects. And so the two sensory systems complement each other. There are some exceptions. As I said earlier, with echolocation, you can hear objects and geometries, and vision can obviously see movement. But basically, if you look at a movie, a cinema presentation, you will see that this distinction is very clearly made. And in fact, if you take an adventure movie and you turn the sound off, the impact disappears. Everything disappears. You can physically see what's going on, but the emotionality, the sense of aliveness, the dynamicness of what the artist is trying to convey is conveyed entirely through sound. And there's a class of artists called Foley artists that manipulate the sound, and they play a big role in having impact. And movies are actually one of the best examples of where the sensory connection takes place, and they have become real masters at it. Slide 10. At this point, I hope I've convinced you that sound and space are tightly linked, and I'm going to argue that they're so tightly linked, we're not even aware of them. And there are three ways that I'm going to represent this linkage. Events have unique recognizable properties, and they are associated with particular spaces. So a restaurant might have a unique set of sounds having to do with background chitter-chatter. A train is a recognizable sound. A horn from a car, a fire truck. There are many, many sounds in our life. A breaking glass is recognizable. We recognize the sounds, and through experience, we associate these sounds with existing in particular spaces. This is an event identification association. Number two, the spatial acoustic changes how events are transported to consciousness. And probably the most obvious example is a concert hall, where we never actually listen to the music directly. And in fact, if you could listen to the music by sticking your ear in the piano, it wouldn't sound very musical. You can't, in fact, separate the transport process in a concert hall from the events that get created on stage. And in fact, a 19th century concert music, the acoustics of the space were actually part of the instrument. The transport process is part of our experience. And the third one is sound, the same sound events that existed in number two also illuminates the spatial objects and geometries. And you can do a simple experiment. If you walk around your house with headphones on and loud music, there's sort of a disconcerting quality because you can't hear the sound of your footsteps. You can't hear the environment. You want to hear things. And in fact, many people develop the ability to walk around in the dark simply by sensing acoustically open doors, low-hanging ceilings. Even a chair in front of you can be heard. These are at least three ways in which sound and space are tightly connected. Slide 11. I'm going to begin to illustrate those three points, and the illustration will probably fail, so you'll have to forgive me. The reason it's going to fail is the space that you are in is so reverberant that the sense of where you are is going to be completely dominated by the environment that you're sitting in. And this actually brings up an interesting point when you want to deal with musical arts and space. There are two spaces involved. And one of them is where the listener is, and the other is where the sound events are taking place. In many cases, these two spaces are the same. So if you had a musician playing at a railroad station, the musician and the listener in the same space. But for this demonstration, there's going to be two different spaces. The spaces where these sound events were recorded and the space where you're going to hear. So let's just play this. If you click on the icon, you can hear this. And what I want you to do as you're listening is think about where you are in terms of identifying these spaces. So let's listen to this for the moment. No doubt each of you could identify most of these different places. And if you were doing this with headphones and just listening, you could feel yourself in an African forest or inside the restaurant or at the ocean. So events identify the place. And many historic musicians tried to mimic the sound of cannons going off, as in the 1812 Overture, or the sounds of birds or bumblebees. The musical tradition of trying to mimic real events because of their identity goes back a long way. And of course, in the sound arts, you can create identities that don't quite exist, that are sort of perversions and transformations of identities. You can build off of identities. Okay, slide 12. Now, this is one of the places where it's probably not going to work too well. I've taken a soprano. And obviously, the first example in a dry, closed space doesn't work because you're not listening there. So you should do the best you can with these spaces, even though really what you're going to hear is your space. So why don't you play this sound source? Okay, I don't know what you could hear, and the microphone is turned off to keep the echo under control. I will eventually distribute this PowerPoint to be posted on some website if you want to host it. And with headphones, the effect of these samples is quite dramatic, and you really get the sense of how you can hear space. And in fact, on my website, I started a project a while back called Spatial Acoustics Ear Training, where I have three lessons up there to teach people to become more aware of these. And as you listen to examples like this, especially since you can switch between them very quickly, you can hear the resonance of the tank. You can hear the ferry car space. You can hear an elevator. And with a little bit of training, you can actually identify where you are just by listening to the sound. Okay, slide 13. Musical spatiality is an example of the second type, where the acoustics of the environment change your experience of the sound. And of course, music is an old tradition. And I've looked at reverberation, which has been studied quite extensively in the design of concert halls. And if you look at reverberation in a concert hall, it serves really two functions. It's what I call temporal spreading. It spreads sound in time, and it spreads sound in space. And these two are completely independent phenomenon, even though they're both created by the same concert hall. Now, of course, with modern technology, you can separate these two, and there's a whole chapter in my book on musical spatiality, but let me just introduce it now as to why it's so critical for music. Temporal spreading is central to such instruments as, say, a clarinet. A clarinet cannot play a chord. It can only do a sequence of notes. You can't get blending between notes. It has sharp onset and termination, and basically does not sound very good if listened to directly. Well, when you play a clarinet at a concert hall, what you hear is the first note extends in time and exists while the second note is coming on and while the third note is coming on. So in some sense, the concert hall allows you to create a meta clarinet, which is capable of creating chord-like experiences, because you get the blending. The same is true for an organ, and if you listen to organists describe their experience, without reverberation and temporal spreading, it sounds dreadful. Most organ music is designed for highly reverberant spaces. Now, this temporal spreading, which is how I began my career, when you're in the recording studio, you can create temporal spreading, which is how I got my career beginning. Now, there's another effect of reverberation in real spaces, and that is reverberation, unlike a sound event, you are in the event, and the reverberant energy is coming from all directions, and you can't localize it. The brain wants to localize all sound, and the inability to localize sound coming from all directions, especially when it's similar, is what I call aural caffeine. It's sort of a mental wake-up, because it's disconcerting to say, I got to pay attention to an event. It has to be located someplace. And enveloping reverberation has no source. You are in it. And this is one of the interesting properties of concert halls, which, of course, you can create electronically. But you can't embed this electronic information in the recording. It can only be done in the playback. So you're sitting in that space. I can't control the envelopingness of the sound, because it's determined by the listening space. Artists have taken advantage of these, and almost all recorded music is inconsistent because they can interact with temporal spreading, spatial spreading, and they can do it separately for each instrument. They can change it in time. And so here's an example where the fixed concert hall gave rise to a kind of flexibility where you can separate experiences simply how you manipulate it. There are musical rules for electroacoustic space, and these are being developed in a trial-and-error basis. Some work, some don't. And ultimately, we remember the concert hall, which was a historic artifact. Obviously, they couldn't separate all these different experiential processes in building a hall. They could only do it by building a hall. We, as electronic musicians, can, of course, separate all these things into our own effects. Okay, slide 14. This was an example many years ago when Stockhausen did a performance in the caves in Lebanon, and he was sort of following the tradition of a concert hall by finding a real space. Of course, the experience in this space could have been done electronically, but at that time he couldn't. I want to read a few quotations about people who were here were there at this performance. The particular acoustics of the grotto had their own role to play. The sounds reverberated for a very long time and sometimes seemed to roll physically for hundreds of meters along the rock walls, accumulating in a manner never experienced in a normal concert hall and stimulating the musicians to shape time and dynamics in a special way. The caves made the sound both prehistoric and also like something out of science fiction. A Catholic priest said of the performance of Stimmung, "It was the longest prayer I've ever known and the happiest." These quotations illustrate that spatial acoustics can have high impact in the experience, and it was difficult for those present to describe it because you don't have a language. And we ourselves can only vaguely imagine what it might have sounded like. Of course, had I been there, I could have discussed it with somebody else who had been there because we would have had a shared experience. But none of us could describe something to somebody who's not had that experience. And that's one of the paradoxes of sound. You can't talk about it. Next slide. This is one of the famous 19th century concert halls, and it has its own peculiar acoustics, very different from the caves in Lebanon. And this concert hall, which is one of the dozen or so classic 19th century concert halls, influenced composers and musicians because they learned to play for the space. The space, in the case of Wagner, was adapted to the music. And real musicians and composers will tell you, you can't separate the space from the music. Space and music are virtually identical in terms of their interdependency. And again, of course, with electronics, you're not limited by this constraint. Slide 16. This also probably won't work. I'm now trying to illustrate how with a simple sound event, you can get a sense of the space. And so let's just try it. What I have here is a set of hand claps in all different spaces. And if you, again, could listen carefully or when you listen to this as a PowerPoint. So let's play this and we'll see how well it does. Okay, I don't know how well you could do with this, but let me just talk a little bit about it. The wall reflection is actually very simple and interesting. When you hear the sound bounce off another surface, and if the delay is 50 or 100 milliseconds, you can hear an echo. The word echo is a description of what you're hearing, but you can also hear a wall. And so you have a choice of saying, I hear a wall or I hear an echo. And for people untrained, they will often describe what gave rise to it. In a similar way, you can say you hear the hardness of a environment. When I was listening to, before the talk began, to your space, I could hear the fact that there were no sound-absorbing elements in there. I could hear the hardness of the wall surface. If we were doing the equivalent talk in an elegant MIT space, it would sound very, very different. You would hear the warmth and softness of all the absorption. And that's actually characteristic of many European spaces. There's a kind of hardness to the acoustics, and maybe this is desirable, maybe not, but it's clearly recognizable. And had I transported you electronically from an American auditorium to the European space you're in, you would hear the difference instantly. Okay, let's continue. Slide 17. I'm not going to try to illustrate this. I'm just going to talk about it. All of us can visualize the environment. You can try this experiment. Many of people have done this. You can hear an open door. You can hear a wall nearby. You can hear rugs and upholstery because they absorb the high frequencies. You can hear the sides of a closet. If I were to blindfold you and put you in a closet, you could hear that you were in a closet. You could hear you were in a cave, a cathedral. In old American buildings and old European buildings with low ceilings, you can hear the low ceiling. There's a class of spaces called whispering galleries. You can hear curved and domed surfaces. And the last one is actually interesting, and that's where the ear can visualize aspects of a space that the eye can't. The eye can see length, width, height, but it can't see volume. The ear can sense volume of a space because the number of cubic meters is perceptible, whereas for the eye, you would have to calculate it. So this is the third element in space and sound. Slide 18. There are a class of blind people over the years who specialized in learning to hear space. And for those who really put a lot of energy into this art form of hearing space, they can get quite good. This is a slide of some teenage blind bicycle riders in the mountains of California. And they are blind riding their bike in the mountains. There are famous stories. For those of you who've either seen the movie or read the book by the jazz singer Ray Charles, who was blind, he taught himself to navigate without a seeing eye dog, without a cane, without any electronic aids. He could walk around as if he were sighted. There's a famous author, Indian author, Ved Mehta, who grew up in Calcutta, and he used to ride his bicycle around Calcutta. The ability to hear space is a special art form. It is not unique to blind people. The only reason it shows up in the blind population is they have the incentive to become very skillful at it. You and I could become equally skillful, but we might say, I'm not going to bother putting that much energy into refining this ability simply because I can use my eyes for navigating. And in fact, what you do with your senses is culturally determined. And as this slide illustrates, if you grew up in a culture where perhaps you didn't have light, or perhaps in, you know, northern climates during the winter where there is no light and you didn't have any artificial light, you might well invest in the ability to hear the environment in terms of geometry and objects. This is a skill. It is not unique to blind people, but blind people are the only ones who might choose to do so. But not all blind people can sense the environment. It is a learned art. Next slide, slide 19. There are other forms of spatiality. And in my book, I define spatiality as experiencing of space. It's not space itself. There are many places where there are unique local acoustics. I call it oral wallpaper. It breaks up monotony. It gives you some texture. And it just adds to the richness of your sensory life. It doesn't serve a function. And in the next slide, slide 20, I have an example of aesthetic spatiality. This is a sculpture done by Semperer in Madrid. It was not designed for its oral experience. It was designed entirely as a visual demonstration. It's an array of stainless steel pipes arranged in a grid with a complex structure. And many years later, a Spanish scientist noticed it had very interesting acoustic properties. It acts like a spatial diffraction grating, breaking up the sound. And as you listen to sound coming through it, you can hear the effect. So this is an example of an oral sculpture, even though it was not intended. And the fact that we don't design for it, or artists don't design for it, is again a cultural accident. He could have designed it for its acoustic properties. He might not have. Okay, let's go on to slide 21. This is another example of the difficulty. The first one was taken in a forest in Africa, and it's a very interesting one for me personally because I'm very proud. When I listen carefully, I experience not just the forest sounds, but if you listen to the baboon, and I'm going to play this now, listen carefully to the reverberant quality of the baboon, and baboons don't do reverberation. And so the question is, how did the baboon create a reverberant sound? And the answer is this particular baboon likes to inhabit big reverberant caves, and they use the caves to broadcast high impact. So let's listen to this. Let's listen to the first one, and then I'll talk about the second. Okay, so here we have two eventscapes that are overlaid. We have the open forest with forest acoustics, and we have the baboon sitting in a cave, which was highly reverberant. And these two eventscapes are overlaid and coupled. Now, if I were in this forest, I would recognize not just the baboon, but where the baboon was. I would hear the fact that the birds and other forest sounds had forest reverberation, which is different than an enclosed space reverberation. All of this is done simply by listening. The next one slide, next to sample I'm going to play, again, I want you to listen to the coupled spaces. You have a big hall, which again you may not hear. You have a baby, and you should be able to identify aspects of the space. So let's play the second sample. I don't know if you can hear it, but at least for me, I could visualize the baby, the people walking around, the kind of space that they were in. I could sense the volume. All this is done by listening. So my point at this point is we've heard three different ways in which space and sounds are coupled, and this has social implications as well as artistic implications. So let's go to the next slide, slide 22, and this is a painting of Hogarth called The Enraged Musicians, and visually you can clearly see there are two spaces. There's the musician in his chamber, and there's the street life going on outside. We think of this as two spaces. From a listening point of view, it's one space. The two eventscapes are coupled. And, of course, the musician is objecting to the coupling of the eventscapes. He wants the privacy and quiet of his chamber so he can be playing music. But he can't have it with the open windows, which no doubt was because it was summer and he needed fresh ventilation. And so you had the combat between who owns the eventscape. And if you look around in ordinary life, you find event combat is a major piece of life. You see this in going to the movies where they may play the sound at a high level so you can't hear anything else. You see this at a railroad station where the sound of the public address system will completely dominate. Motorcyclists riding through the streets in the middle of the night are producing combat of eventscapes. Nobody owns the eventscape, and these events are broadcast over large distances. And as all forms of combat, the one with the biggest energy wins. How are we doing for time? I'll keep going for another. I guess I'm almost done. Let me just quickly finish, and then we'll turn it into questions. Okay, slide 23. This is the general topic of overlaid eventscapes. They're not a single eventscape. They can be overlaid. Headphones is one of the classic examples of overlaying them. You can hear the space coming out of your headphones, and if they're not sealed to your head, you can hear the space you're in. A couple of years ago, three people in New York City were killed walking across the street because they had headphones on with loud music. They were embedded in the eventscape of their music. They were not embedded in the eventscape of trucks making noise coming at them, and they were killed, literally killed. You need to have an eventscape to sense events, and with the electronic use of headphones, which is one way to control the eventscape you're in, you also lose something by not having access to another eventscape. And many people blow their ears out by using loud music and headphones simply to get rid of the eventscape they're in and wanting to be in it. So you get individual control as part of the combat, and unfortunately it can be destructive. Slide 24, we're getting to the end. I've defined oral architecture as the influence of passive objects and geometries on the emotions and behavior of people in the space. It's the counterpart to visual architecture. There's a Finnish architect who, in fact, came up with the concept of sensory architecture, which goes back to the earlier point about sensory deprivation. We experience where we are with all the senses. Sound is one of the major importances of it. Slide 25, we're getting to summary. In the book, I articulate five types of spatiality. Actually, I only mentioned four in the book. I expanded that. Spatiality is how you experience space. And there are social implications of how you experience oral architecture, navigational, musical, aesthetic, symbolic. This is the phenomenology of oral space. It is not the physicality of it. And we'll do the last slide, 26. No, not quite the last. Okay. Oral architecture changes your experience of the eventscape. You need to be aware of it. Unfortunately, you can't completely control it because oral architecture is created by the environment you're in, who built it, what people are doing to it. You could clearly change the eventscape just by putting sound-absorbing material in there. The more people that are in there, the more absorption you get. It's not under direct control of the artist. And let me get to the last slide, 27. Here's a summary of what I've been trying to represent. The audible eventscape is composed of the oral architecture and the sonic events, and together they give you the experience of space and place. And I guess that's my representation of my view of sound and space. So I guess we can take questions. I've been going for 45 minutes, and we can open up the mic, and hopefully I'll hear something.
Well, my questions, I had two questions about localization of sound, whether there had been any studies done on the resolution of our ability to localize sound, whether, you know, how finely we can localize sound in space, or if that sort of grid is, or, you know, how distant sounds have to, I'm sure it's dependent on frequency and other factors, but just wondered if there had been any studies on that. And also, I had the experience also in your recording of the train, where it wasn't spatialized or it wasn't moving, but my reaction was to sort of create a, or my brain sort of wanted it to move, and it sort of, I was sensing a strong direction in the sound, and I was wondering if we tend to localize in terms of, like, almost like a vector, like in terms of hearing direction, so that we can anticipate where a sound will end up, if that's part of our kind of survival mechanism.
As for localization, that's probably been studied for thousands of man years. There's an incredibly vast literature on how people localize sound. I can give you a quick summary of it. The way you localize sound is the sound event arriving with the sound waves hits your two ears at a different time. The ear that's closest to the sound gets it first, and those few hundred microseconds difference as it takes the sound to get from one ear to the other, if you're not looking at it directly, is decodable. Also, the head produces shadowing. And so to answer your question, you can experience the localization reasonably accurately depending on the spectral and temporal content of the sound source, clicks, sine waves, fast onset, low frequencies, high frequencies, all of those contribute to how well you can localize. And then the localization gets more complicated because in a space there are also lots of reflections depending upon the space you're in. The localization has to be done on the direct sound, and depending on how much masking gets done, it corrupts it. In a forest, you get a dispersion of high and low frequencies. So the answer to your question is there's a vast literature. It's unbelievably vast. You could spend four lifetimes studying it, and it depends on virtually everything. As for the second question, I can't prove that your hypothesis is correct, but my sense is not only do you try to localize the event, but you actually build a picture of what's happening. And the fact that movement is part of the experience of the outside world, I have no doubt that you not only localize the event, but you actually sense the movement. Certainly we sense Doppler shift for things approaching us or going away. You sense the directionality as it goes from more to the left ear to the right ear. And so I have absolutely no doubt that you're building a much richer model, which includes localization, space, direction, change. The brain is designed to build a model of space. The mechanism by which it does that is strictly an evolutionary accident.
Okay, thank you. Shall we have another question? Okay, thank you so much. We're going to continue here.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Bye-bye.